from the Christian Classics Ethereal Library on the web at www.ccel.org. 1870, Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy, translated by Constance Garnett. Part 1, Vengeance is Mine, I Will Repay. Chapter 1. Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Everything was in confusion in the Oblonsky's house. The wife had discovered that the husband was carrying on an intrigue with a French girl who had been a governess in their family, and she had announced to her husband that she could not go on living in the same house with him. This position of affairs had now lasted 2 days, and not only the husband and wife themselves, but all the members of their family and the household were painfully conscious of it. All the members of the family and the household felt that there was no sense in their living together, and that even stray people brought together by chance in an inn had more in common with one another than they, the members of the family and the household of the Oblonskys. The wife did not leave her own apartments. The husband had not been home for 2 days. The children ran wild all over the house. The English governess quarreled with the housekeeper and wrote to a friend asking her to look out for a new employ for her. The man cook had walked off the day before just at dinner time. The kitchen maid and the coachman had been given warning. 2 days after the quarrel, Prince Stepan Arkadyevich Oblonsky, Stiva, as he was called in the fashionable world, woke up at his usual hour, that is at 8 o'clock in the morning, not in his wife's bedroom but on the leather-covered sofa in his study. He turned over his stout, well-cared-for person on the springy sofa as though he would sink into a long sleep again. He vigorously embraced the pillow on its other side and buried his face in it. But all at once he jumped up, sat up on the sofa, and opened his eyes. Yes, yes, how was it now, he thought, going over his dream. Yes, how was it? Yes, Alaban was giving a dinner at Darmstadt. No, not Darmstadt, but something American. Yes, but then Darmstadt was in America. Yes, Alaban was giving a dinner on glass tables, and the tables sang, Il mio tesoro. No, not Il mio tesoro, but something better. And there were some sort of little decanters on the table, and at the same time, these decanters were women, he recalled. Stepan Arkadyevich's eyes twinkled gaily, and he pondered with a smile. Yes, it was jolly, very jolly. There was a great deal more that was delightful, only there's no putting it into words or even expressing it in one's waking thoughts. And noticing a gleam of light peeping in beside one of the woolen cloth curtains, he cheerfully dropped his feet over the edge of the sofa and felt about with them for his slippers, a present on his last birthday, worked for him by his wife on gold-colored morocco. And as he used to do for the last 9 years, he stretched out his hand without getting up toward the place where his dressing gown always hung in the bedroom. And thereupon he suddenly remembered that he was not sleeping in his wife's room but in his study, as well as the reason. The smile vanished from his face and he knit his brows. Oh, he muttered, recalling everything that had happened. And again, every detail of his quarrel with his wife was present to his imagination. All the hopelessness of his position, and worst of all, his own fault. Yes, she won't forgive me, and she can't forgive me. And the most awful thing about it is that it's all my fault. All my fault, though I'm not to blame. That's the point of the whole tragedy, he reflected. Oh, he kept repeating in despair as he remembered the acutely painful sensations caused him by this quarrel. Most unpleasant of all was the first minute when, on coming from the theater, good-humored and light-hearted, with a huge pear in his hand for his wife, he had not found his wife in the drawing-room, to his surprise, nor in the study, but saw her at last in her bedroom, clutching the unlucky letter that revealed everything. She, his Dolly, forever fussing and worrying over household details, and limited in her ideas, as he considered, was sitting motionless with the letter in her hand, looking at him with an expression of horror, despair, and indignation. "What is this?" "This," she asked, pointing to the letter. And at this recollection, Stepan Arkadyevich, as is so often the case, was not so much annoyed at the fact itself as at the way in which he had met his wife's words. There happened to him at that instant that which happens to people when they are unexpectedly caught in something very disgraceful. He did not succeed in adapting his face to the situation in which he was placed toward his wife by the discovery of his fault. Instead of being hurt, denying, defending himself, begging forgiveness, instead of remaining indifferent even, anything would have been better than what he did do. His face, utterly without his volition, cerebral reflexes, mused Stepan Arkadyevich, who was fond of physiology, had assumed its habitual good-humored and therefore stupid smile. This stupid smile he could not forgive himself. Catching sight of that smile, Dolly shuddered as though from physical pain, broke out with her characteristic heat into a flood of cruel words, and rushed out of the room. Since then, she had refused to see her husband. "It's all the fault of that stupid smile," Stepan Arkadyevich was thinking. "But what's to be done? What's to be done?" he kept saying to himself in despair, and found no answer. Chapter 2. Stepan Arkadyevich was a truthful man in his relations with himself. He was incapable of self-deception and of persuading himself that he repented his conduct. He could not at this date repent the fact that he, handsome, susceptible to love, a man of 34, was not in love with his wife, the mother of 5 living and 2 dead children, and only a year younger than himself. All he repented was that he had not succeeded better in hiding this from his wife. But he felt all the difficulty of his position and was sorry for his wife, his children, and himself. Possibly he might have managed to conceal his sins better from his wife if he had anticipated that the knowledge of them would have had such an effect upon her. He had never clearly reflected on the subject, but he had vaguely conceived that his wife must long ago have suspected him of being unfaithful to her and had shut her eyes to the fact. He had even supposed that she, a worn-out woman, no longer young or good-looking, and in no way remarkable or uncommon, merely a good mother, ought from a sense of fairness to take an indulgent view. It had turned out quite the other way. "Oh, it's awful. Oh, dear, awful," Stepan Arkadyevich kept repeating to himself, and he could think of nothing to be done. And how well things were going up until now. How well we got on. She was contented and happy in her children. I never interfered with her in anything. I let her manage the children in the house just as she liked. True, it's bad her having been a governess in our house. That's bad. There's something common, vulgar, in flirting with one's governess. But what a governess. He vividly recalled the roguish black eyes of Mademoiselle Roland and her smile. But after all, while she was in the house, I kept myself in hand. And the worst of it all is that she's already, it seems as if ill luck would have it, so, but what is to be done? There was no solution save that universal solution which life gives to all questions, even the most complex and insolvable. One must live in the needs of the day, that is, forget oneself. To forget himself in sleep was impossible now. At least till nighttime. He could not go back now to the music sung by the decanter women, so he must forget himself in the dream of daily life. "Then we shall see," Stepan Arkadyevich said to himself, and getting up he put on a gray dressing gown lined with blue silk, tied the tassels in a knot, and drawing a deep breath of air into his broad chest, he walked to the window with his usual confident step, turning out his feet that carried his full frame so easily. He pulled up the blind and rang the bell loudly. It was at once answered by the appearance of an old friend, his valet, Matvey, carrying his clothes, his boots, and a telegram. Matvey was followed by the barber with all the necessaries for shaving. "Are there any papers from the board?" asked Stepan Arkadyevich, taking the telegram and seating himself at the looking-glass. On the table, replied Nappy, glancing with inquiring sympathy at his master, and after a short pause he added with a sly smile, they've sent from the carriage jobber. Stepan Arkadyevitch made no reply, but merely glanced at Nappy in the looking-glass. The glance in which their eyes met in the looking-glass made it clear that they understood one another. Stepan Arkadyevitch's eyes seemed to ask, why do you tell me that? Don't you know? Nappy put his hands in his jacket pockets, thrust out one leg, and gazed silently with a good-humored faint smile at his master. I told them to come on Sunday, and till then not to trouble you or themselves for nothing, he said. He had obviously prepared the sentence beforehand. Stepan Arkadyevitch saw Matvey wanted to make a joke and attract attention to himself. Tearing open the telegram, he read it through, guessing at the words, misspelled as they always are in telegrams, and his face brightened. Matvey, my sister Anna Arkadyevna will be here tomorrow, he said, checking for a minute the sleek, plump hand of the barber, cutting a pink path between his long, curly side whiskers. Thank God, said Matvey, showing by this response that he, like his master, realized the significance of this arrival. Anna Arkadyevna, the sister his master was so fond of, might bring about a reconciliation between husband and wife. Alone or with her husband, inquired Matvey. Stepan Arkadyevitch could not answer, as the barber was at work on his upper lip, and he raised one finger. Matvey nodded at the looking glass. Alone. Is this the room to be got ready upstairs? Inform Darya Alexandrovna where she orders. Darya Alexandrovna? Matvey repeated as though in doubt. Yes, inform her. Here, take the telegram, give it to her, and then do what she tells you. You want to try it out? Matvey guessed, but only said, yes, sir. Stepan Arkadyevitch was already washed and combed and ready to be dressed when Matvey, stepping slowly in his creaky boots, came back into the room with the telegram in his hand. The barber had gone. Darya Alexandrovna told me to inform you that she is going away. Let him, that is you, do as he likes, he said, laughing only with his eyes and putting his hands in his pockets. He watched his master with his head on one side. Stepan Arkadyevitch was silent a minute. Then a good humor and rather pitiful smile showed itself on his handsome face. Eh, Matvey, he said, shaking his head. Never mind, sir, everything will come around, said Matvey. Come round? Just so, sir. You think so? Who's there? Asked Stepan Arkadyevitch, hearing the rustle of a woman's dress at the door. It's I, said a firm, pleasant feminine voice, and the stern, pockmarked face of Matryona Filimonovna, the nurse, was thrust at the door. Well, what's the matter, Matryosha? Queried Stepan Arkadyevitch, meeting her in the doorway. Although Stepan Arkadyevitch was completely in the wrong as regards his wife, and was conscious of this himself, almost everyone in the house, even the nurse, Darya Alexandrovna's chief ally, was on his side. Well, what now? He asked cheerlessly. Go to her, sir. Own your fault again. Maybe God will aid you. She is suffering, so it's pitiful to see her, and besides, everything in the house is topsy-turvy. You must have pity, sir, on the children. Beg her forgiveness, sir. There's no help for it. One must pay the piper. But she won't see me. You do your part. God is merciful. Pray to God, sir. Pray to God. Come, that'll do. You can go, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, blushing suddenly. Well, now let's dress. He turned to Matvey and resolutely threw off his dressing gown. Matvey was already holding up the shirt like a horse's collar and blowing off some invisible speck. He slipped it with obvious pleasure over the well-cared-for person of his master. Chapter 3. When he was dressed, Stepan Arkadyevitch sprinkled some scent on himself, pulled down his shirt cuffs, distributed into his pockets his cigarettes, pocketbook, matches, and watch, with its double chain and seals, and shaking out his handkerchief, feeling himself clean, fragrant, healthy, and physically at ease, in spite of his misfortune, he walked with a slight swing of each leg into the dining room, where coffee was already waiting for him, and, alongside of his cup, the letters and papers from the office. He read the letters. One was very unpleasant, from a merchant who was buying a forest on his wife's property. To sell this forest was absolutely essential, but at present, until he was reconciled with his wife, the subject could not be discussed. The most unpleasant thing of all was that his pecuniary interest should in this way enter into the question of his reconciliation with his wife, and the idea that he might be led on by its interest, that he might seek a reconciliation with his wife on account of the sale of the forest, that idea hurt him. When he had finished his letters, Stepan Arkadyevich moved the office papers close to him, rapidly looked through two cases, made a few notes with a big pencil, and pushing away the papers, turned to his coffee. Sipping it, he opened a still damp morning paper and began to read it. Stepan Arkadyevich took in and read a liberal paper, not an extreme one, but one advocating the views held by the majority. And in spite of the fact that science, art, and politics had no special interest for him, he firmly held those views on all these subjects which were held by the majority and by his paper, and he only changed them when the majority changed them, or, more strictly speaking, he did not change them, but they imperceptibly changed of themselves within him. Stepan Arkadyevich has not chosen his political opinions or his views. These political opinions and views had come to him of themselves, just as he did not choose the shapes of his hat and coat, but simply accepted those that were being worn. And for him, living in a certain society, owing to the need ordinarily developed at years of discretion for some degree of mental activity, to have views was just as indispensable as to have a hat. If there was a reason for his preferring liberal to conservative views, which were held also by many of his circle, it arose not from his considering liberalism more rational, but from its being in closer accordance with his manner of life. The liberal party said that in Russia everything was wrong, and indeed Stepan Arkadyevich had many debts and was decidedly short of money. The liberal party said that marriage was an institution quite out of date, and that it stood in need of reconstruction. And indeed, family life afforded Stepan Arkadyevich little gratification and forced him into lying and hypocrisy, which was so repulsive to his nature. The liberal party said, or rather allowed it to be understood, that religion was only a curb to keep in check the barbarous classes of the people. And indeed, Stepan Arkadyevich could not stand through even a short service without his legs aching, and could never make out what was the object of all the terrible and high-flown language about another world when life might be so very amusing in this world. And with all this, Stepan Arkadyevich, who liked a merry joke, was fond of embarrassing some plain man by saying that if one were to pride oneself on one's origin, one ought not to stop at Rurik and disown the founder of the line, the monkey. And so liberalism had become a habit of Stepan Arkadyevich, and he liked his newspaper, as he did his cigar after dinner, for a slight fog it diffused in his brain. He read the leading article, which maintained that it was quite senseless in our day to raise an outcry that radicalism was threatening to swallow up all conservative elements, and that the government ought to take measures to crush the revolutionary hydra. That, on the contrary, in our opinion, the danger lies not in that imaginary revolutionary hydra, but in the obstinacy of traditionalism clogging progress, etc., etc. He read another article, too, a financial one, which alluded to Bentham and Mill, and dropped some innuendos reflecting on the ministry. With his characteristic quick-wittedness, he caught the drift of each innuendo, divided whence it came, at whom, and on what ground it was aimed, and that afforded him, as it always did, a certain gratification. But today that gratification was embittered by Matryona Philimonovna's advice and the unsatisfactory state of his household. He read, too, that Count Beast was rumored to have left for Wiesbaden, and that one need have no more gray hair, and of the sale of a light carriage, and of a young person seeking a situation. But these items of information did not give him, as usual, a quiet, ironical gratification. Having finished the paper, a second cup of coffee, and a roll and butter, he got up, shaking the crumbs off his waistcoat, and squaring his broad chest, he smiled joyously, not because there was anything particularly agreeable in his mind. The joyous smile was evoked by a good digestion. But this joyous smile at once recalled everything to him, and he grew thoughtful. Two childish voices. Stepan Arkadyevich recognized the voices of Grisha, his youngest boy, and Tanya, his eldest girl, were heard outside the door. They were carrying something and dropped it. "I told you not to sit passengers on the roof," said the little girl in English. "There, pick them up." "Everything's in confusion," thought Stepan Arkadyevich. "There are the children running about by themselves," and going to the door, he called them. They left off the box that represented a train and came into their father. The little girl, her father's favorite, ran up boldly, embraced him, and hung laughingly on his neck, enjoying, as she always did, the well-known smell of scent that came from his whiskers. At last the little girl kissed his face, which was flushed from his stooping posture, and beaming with tenderness, loosed her hands and was about to run away again, but her father held her back. "How is Mama?" he asked, passing his hand over his daughter's smooth, soft little neck. "Good morning," he said, smiling to the boy who had come up to greet him. He was conscious that he loved the boy less and always tried to be fair, but the boy felt it and did not smile responsively to his father's chilly smile. "Mama?" "She is up," answered the girl. Stepan Arkadyevich sighed. "That means she hasn't slept again all night," he thought. "Well, is she cheerful?" The little girl knew that there was a quarrel between her father and mother, and that her mother could not be cheerful, and that her father must be aware of this, and that he was pretending when he asked about it so lightly, and she blushed for her father. He at once perceived it and blushed too. "I don't know," she said. "She did not say we must do our lessons, but she said we were to go for a walk with Miss Cooley to Grandmama's." "Well, go, Tanya, my darling." "Oh, wait a minute, though," he said, still holding her and stroking her soft little hand. He took off the mantelpiece, where he had put it yesterday, a little box of sweets, and gave her two, picking out her favorites, a chocolate and a bonbon. "For Grisha?" said the little girl, pointing to the chocolate. "Yes, yes," and still stroking her little shoulder, he kissed the nape of her neck and let her go. "The carriage is ready," said Matvey, "but there's someone to see you with petition." "Been here long?" asked Stepan Arkadyevich. "Half an hour or so." "How many times have I told you to tell me at once?" "One must let you drink your coffee in peace, at least," said Matvey, in the affectionately gruff tone with which it was impossible to be angry. "Well, show the person up at once," said Oblonsky, frowning with vexation. The petitioner, the widow of a staff captain, Kalinin, came with a request impossible and unreasonable. But Stepan Arkadyevich, as he generally did, made her sit down, heard her to the end attentively without interrupting her, and gave her detailed advice as to how and to whom to apply, and even wrote for her, easily and clearly, in his large, sprawling, telegraphic, and legible hand, a little note to a personage who might be of use to her. Having got rid of the staff captain's widow, Stepan Arkadyevich took his hat and stopped to recollect whether he had forgotten anything. It appeared that he had forgotten nothing, except what he wanted to forget, his wife. "Ah, yes," he bowed his head, and his handsome face assumed a melancholy expression. "To go or not to go," he said to himself, and an inner voice told him he must not go, that nothing could come of it but falsity, that to amend, to set right their relations was impossible, because it was impossible to make her attractive again and able to inspire love, or to make him an old man not susceptible to love. Except deceit and lying, nothing could come of it now, and deceit and lying were opposed to his nature. "It must be some day, though. It can't go on like this," he said. trying to give himself courage. He set straight his chest, took out a cigarette, lighted it, took two whiffs at it, flung it into a mother-of-pearl ashtray, and with rapid steps walked through the drawing room and opened the other door into his wife's bedroom. Chapter 4. Darya Alexandrovna, in a dressing jacket, and with her now scanty hair, once luxuriant and beautiful, fastened up with hairpins on the nape of her neck, with a sunken thin face and large startled eyes, which looked prominent from the thinness of her face, was standing among a litter of all sorts of things scattered all over the room, before an open bureau from which she was taking something. Hearing her husband's step, she stopped, looking toward the door, and trying in vain to give her features a severe and contemptuous expression. She felt she was afraid of him and afraid of the coming interview. She was just attempting to do what she had attempted to do 10 times already in these last 3 years, to sort out the children's things and her own, so as to take them to her mother's, and again she could not bring herself to do this. But now again, as each time before, she kept saying to herself that things cannot go on like this, that she must undertake something, punish him, put him to shame, avenge on him some little part at least of the suffering he had caused her. She still continued to tell herself that she should leave him, but she was conscious that this was impossible. It was impossible because she could not get out of the habit of regarding him as her husband and of loving him. Besides this, she realized that even here in her own house, she could hardly manage to look after her 5 children properly. They would be still worse off where she was going with all of them. As it was, even in the course of these 3 days, the youngest was unwell from being given unwholesome soup, and the others had almost gone without their dinner the day before. She was conscious that it was impossible to go away, but cheating herself, she went on all the same, sorting out her things and pretending she was going. Seeing her husband, she dropped her hands into the drawer of the bureau as though looking for something, and only looked round at him when he had come quite up to her. But her face, to which she tried to give a severe and resolute expression, expressed bewilderment and suffering. "Dolly," he said in a subdued and timid voice. He had hunched up his shoulders and tried to look pitiful and humble, but for all that, he was radiant with freshness and health. In a rapid glance, she scanned his figure, beaming with freshness and health. "Yes, he is happy and content," she thought, "while I, and that disgusting good nature which everyone likes him for and praises, I hate that good nature of his," she thought. Her mouth stiffened, the muscles of her cheek trembled on the right side of her pale, nervous face. "What do you want?" she said in a rapid, deep, unnatural voice. "Dolly," he repeated with a quiver in his voice. "Anna is coming today." "Well, what is that to me? I can't see her," she cried. "But you must, really, Dolly." "Go away, go away, go away," she shrieked without looking at him, as though this shriek were called up by physical pain. Stepan Arkadyevich could be calm when he thought of his wife. He could hope that everything would come round, as Matvey expressed it, and had been able to go on reading his paper and drinking his coffee. But when he saw her tortured, suffering face, heard the tone of her voice, submissive to fate and full of despair, his breath was cut short, and a lump came to his throat, and his eyes began to shine with tears. "My God, what have I done? Dolly, for God's sake, you know..." He could not go on. There was a sob in his throat. She shut the bureau with a slam and glanced at him. "Dolly, what can I say? One thing. Forgive me. Remember, cannot 9 years of our life atone for an instant?" She dropped her eyes and listened, expecting what he would say, as if beseeching him in some way or other to make her believe differently. "Instant of passion," he said, and would have gone on, but at that word, as at a pang of physical pain, her lips stiffened again, and again the muscles of her right cheek worked. "Go away, get out of the room," she shrieked still more shrilly. "And don't talk to me of your passions and your vilenesses." She tried to go out, but tottered and clung to the back of a chair to support herself. His face relaxed. His lips became puffy. Tears welled up in his eyes. "Dolly," he said, sobbing now, For mercy's sake, think of the children. They are not to blame. I am to blame. Punish me, then. Make me expiate my fault. Anything I can do, I am ready to do. I am to blame. No words can express how much I am to blame. But, Dolly, forgive me. She sat down. He listened to her hard, heavy breathing, and he was unutterably sorry for her. She made several attempts to speak, but could not. He waited. You remember the children, Stiva, to play with them. But I remember and know that they go to ruin now, she said, obviously one of the phrases she had more than once repeated to herself in the course of the last 3 days. She had called him Stiva, and he glanced at her with gratitude and moved to take her hand, but she drew back from him with aversion. I remember the children, and for that reason I would do anything in the world to save them, but I don't myself know the means. By taking them away from their father, or by leaving them with a vicious father? Yes, a vicious father. Tell me, after what has happened, can we live together? Is that possible? Do tell me, is it possible? She repeated, raising her voice. After my husband, the father of my children, enters into a love affair with his own children's governess? But what's to be done? What's to be done? He kept saying in a pitiful voice, not knowing what he was saying as his head sank lower and lower. You are loathsome to me, repulsive, she shrieked, getting more and more heated. Your tears mean nothing. You have never loved me. You have neither a heart nor a sense of honor. You are hateful to me, disgusting, a stranger, yes, a complete stranger. With pain and wrath, she uttered the word so terrible to herself, stranger. He looked at her, and the fury expressed in her face alarmed and amazed him. He did not understand that it was his pity for her that exasperated her. She saw in him compassion for her, but not love. No, she hates me. She will never forgive me, he thought. It is awful, awful, he said. At that moment in the next room, a child began to cry. Probably it had fallen down. Darya Alexandrovna listened, and her face suddenly softened. She seemed pulling herself together for a few seconds as though she did not know where she was nor what she was doing. And getting up rapidly, she moved toward the door. Well, she loves my child, he thought, noticing the change of her face at the child's cry. My child. How can she hate me, then? Dolly, one word more, he said, following her. If you follow me, I will call in the servants and the children. Let them all know you are a scoundrel. I am going away at once, and you may live here with your mistress. She went out, slamming the door. Stepan Arkadyevich sighed, mopped his face, and with a subdued tread walked out of the room. Matin says everything will come round, but how? I don't see the least chance of it. Ah, how horrible it is. And how vulgarly he shouted, he said to himself, remembering her shrieks and the words scoundrel and mistress, and very likely the maids were listening. Horribly vulgar, horribly. Stepan Arkadyevich stood a few seconds alone, wiped his eyes, thrust out his chest, and walked out of the room. It was Friday, and in the dining room the watchmaker, a German, was winding up the clock. Stepan Arkadyevich remembered his joke about this punctual, bald watchmaker, that the German was wound up for a whole lifetime himself to wind up watches, and he smiled. Stepan Arkadyevich was fond of a nice joke. And maybe it will come round. That's a good expression. Come round, he thought. I must tell that. Matvey, he shouted, arrange everything with Maria in the sitting room for Anna Arkadyevna, he said to Matvey when he came in. Yes, sir. Stepan Arkadyevich put on his fur coat and went out on the front steps. You won't dine at home, said Matvey, seeing him off. It all depends. But here's for the housekeeping, he said, taking 10 rubles from his pocketbook. Will it be enough? Enough or not enough, we must make it do, said Matvey, slamming the carriage door and going back to the steps. Darya Alexandrovna, meanwhile, having pacified the child and knowing from the sound of the carriage that he had gone off, went back to her bedroom. It was her only refuge from the household cares which crowded upon her directly when she went out from it. Even now, in the short time she had been in the nursery, the English governess and Matryona Filimonovna had succeeded in putting several questions to her, which did not admit of delay, and which only she could answer. What were the children to put on for their walk? Should they have any milk? Should not a new cook be sent for? "Oh, let me alone," she said, and going back to her bedroom, she sat down in the same place she had occupied when talking to her husband, clasping tightly her thin hands, her rings slipping down on her bony fingers, and fell to going over her recollections of the entire interview. "He is gone. But what has he finally arrived at with her?" she thought. "Can it be he sees her? Why didn't I ask him? No, no reconciliation is impossible. Even if we remain in the same house, we are strangers, strangers forever." And she repeated again with special significance the words so dreadful to her. "And how I loved him. My God, how I loved him. How I loved him. And now, don't I love him? Don't I love him more than before?" "The most horrible thing is," she began, but did not finish her thought because Matryona Filimonovna put her head in at the door. "Let us send for my brother," she said. "He can get a dinner anyway, or we shall have the children getting nothing to eat till 6 again, like yesterday." "Very well, I will come directly and see about it. But did you send for some new milk?" And Darya Alexandrovna plunged into the duties of the day and drowned her grief in them for a time. Chapter 5. Stepan Arkadyevich had learned easily at school, thanks to his excellent abilities, but he had been idle and mischievous, and therefore was one of the lowest in his class. But in spite of his habitually dissipated mode of life, his inferior grade in the service, and his comparative youth, he occupied the honorable and lucrative position of president of one of the government boards at Moscow. This post he had received through his sister Anna's husband, Alexei Alexandrovich Karenin, who held one of the most important positions in the ministry to which the Moscow office belonged. But if Karenin had not got his brother-in-law this berth, then through 100 other personages, brothers, sisters, cousins, uncles, and aunts, Stiva Oblonsky would have received this post or some other like it, together with the salary of $6,000 absolutely needful for him, as his affairs, in spite of his wife's considerable property, were in a poor state. Half of Moscow and Petersburg were friends and relations of Stepan Arkadyevich. He was born in the midst of those who had been and had become the powerful ones of this world. One-third of the men in the government, the older men, had been friends of his father's and had known him in pinafores. Another third were his intimate chums, and the remainder were friendly acquaintances. Consequently, the distributors of earthly blessings in the shape of posts, rents, concessions, and such were all his friends and could not overlook one of their own set. And Oblonsky had no need to make any special exertion to get a lucrative post. He had only not to refuse things, not to show jealousy, not to be quarrelsome or take offense, all of which, from his characteristic good nature, he never did. It would have struck him as absurd if he had been told that he would not get a position with the salary he required, especially as he expected nothing out of the way. He only wanted what the men of his own age and standing did get, and he was no worse qualified for performing duties of this kind than any other man. He was not merely liked by all who knew him for his good humor, his bright disposition, and his unquestionable honesty. In him, in his handsome, radiant figure, his sparkling eyes, black hair and eyebrows, and his white and pink complexion, there was something which produced a physical effect of kindliness and a good humor on the people who met him. "Aha, Stiva Oblonsky, the man himself," was almost always said with a smile of delight on meeting him, even though it happened at times that after a conversation with him, it seemed that nothing particularly delightful had happened. The next day and the next, everyone was just as delighted to meet him again. After filling for 2 years the post of president of one of the government boards at Moscow, Stepan Arkadyevich had won the respect as well as the liking of his fellow officials, subordinates and superiors, and all who had had business with him. The principal qualities in Stepan Arkadyevich, which had gained him this universal respect in the service, consisted, in the first place, of his extreme indulgence for others, founded on a consciousness of his own shortcomings. Secondly, of his perfect liberalism, not the liberalism he read of in the papers, but the liberalism that was in his blood, in virtue of which he treated all men perfectly equally and exactly the same, whatever their fortune or rank might be. And thirdly, the most important point, of his complete indifference to the business in which he was engaged, in consequence of which he was never carried away and made no mistakes. On reaching the offices of the board, Stepan Arkadyevich, escorted by a deferential porter with a portfolio, went into his little private room, put on his uniform, and went into the boardroom. The clerks and officials all rose, greeting him with a good-humored deference. Stepan Arkadyevich moved quickly, as always, to his place, shook hands with the members of the board, and sat down. He made a joke or two and talked just as much as was consistent with due decorum, and began work. No one knew better than Stepan Arkadyevich how to hit on that exact limit of freedom, simplicity, and official stiffness which is necessary for the agreeable conduct of business. A secretary, with the good-humored deference common to everyone in Stepan Arkadyevich's office, came up with papers and began to speak in the familiar and easy tone which had been introduced by Stepan Arkadyevich. "We have succeeded in getting the information from the government department of Penza. Here, would you care?" "You've got it at last," said Stepan Arkadyevich, laying his finger on the paper. "Now, gentlemen." And the sitting of the board began. "If they but knew," he thought, inclining his head with an important ear and listening to the report, "what a guilty little boy their president was half an hour ago." And his eyes were laughing during the reading of the report. Till 2 o'clock, the sitting would go on without a break. Then there would be an interval and luncheon. It was not yet 2 when the large glass door of the boardroom suddenly opened and someone came in. All the members of the board sitting at the table, from below the portrait of the Tsar and from behind the mirror of justice, delighted at any distraction, looked round at the door, but the doorkeeper standing there at once drove out the intruder and closed the glass door after him. When the case had been read through, Stepan Arkadyevich got up and stretched, and by way of tribute to the liberalism of the time, took out a cigarette, being in the boardroom, and went into his private room. 2 of his board fellows, the old veteran in the service, Nikitin, and the kammerjunker Grinevich, went in with him. "We have time to finish after lunch," said Stepan Arkadyevich. "To be sure we shall," said Nikitin. "A pretty sharp fellow, this Fomin, it must be," said Grinevich, of one of the persons taking part in the case they were examining. Stepan Arkadyevich frowned at Grinevich's words, giving him thereby to understand that it was improper to pass judgment prematurely, and made him no reply. "Who was it who came in?" he asked the doorkeeper. "Some fellow, Your Excellency, sneaked in without permission directly my back was turned. He was asking for you. I told him. When the members come out, then, where is he?" "Maybe he's gone into the passage. He was strolling here till now." "That's he," said the doorkeeper, pointing to a strongly built, broad-shouldered man with a curly beard, who, without taking off his sheepskin cap, was running lightly and rapidly up the worn steps of the stone staircase. One of the officials going down, a lean fellow with a portfolio, stood out of his way, looked disapprovingly at the legs of the running man, and then glanced inquiringly at Oblonsky. Stepan Arkadyevich was standing at the top of the stairs, his good-naturedly beaming face above the embroidered collar of his uniform beamed more than ever when he recognized the man coming up. "Why, it's actually you, Levin, at last," he said with a friendly mocking smile, gazing on the approaching man. "How is it you have deigned to look me up in this den?" said Stepan Arkadyevich, and not content with shaking hands, he kissed his friend. "Have you been here long?" "I have just come and very much wanted to see you," said Levin, looking about him shyly and at the same time angrily and uneasily. "Well, let's go into my room," said Stepan Arkadyevich, who knew his friend's sensitive and irritable shyness and taking his arm, he drew him along as though guiding him through dangers. Stepan Arkadyevich was on familiar terms with almost all his acquaintances and called almost all of them by their Christian names. Old men of 60, boys of 20, actors, ministers, merchants, and adjutant generals, so that many of his intimate chums were to be found at the extreme ends of the social ladder, and would have been very much surprised to learn that they had, through the medium of Oblonsky, something in common. He was the familiar friend of everyone with whom he took a glass of champagne, and he took a glass of champagne with everyone. And when, in consequence, he met any of his disreputable chums, as he used to joke to call many of his friends, in the presence of his subordinates, he well knew how, with his characteristic tact, to diminish any possible disagreeable impression. Levin was not a disreputable chum, but Oblonsky, with his ready tact, felt that Levin fancied Oblonsky might not care to show his intimacy with him before subordinates, and so Stepan Arkadyevich made haste to take him off into his room. Levin was almost of the same age as Oblonsky. Their intimacy did not rest merely on champagne. Levin had been the friend and companion of his early youth. They were fond of one another in spite of the difference of their characters and tastes, as friends are fond of one another who have been together in early youth. But in spite of this, each of them, as is often the way with men who have selected careers of different kinds, though in discussion he would even justify the other's career, in his heart despised it. It seemed to each of them that the life he led himself was the only real life, and the life led by his friend was a mere phantasm. Oblonsky could not restrain a slight mocking smile at the sight of Levin. How often he had seen him come up to Moscow from the country, where he was doing something, but what, precisely, Stepan Arkadyevich could never quite make out, and indeed took no interest in the matter. Levin arrived in Moscow, always excited and in a hurry, rather ill at ease, and irritated by his own want of ease, and for the most part with a perfectly new, unexpected view of things. Stepan Arkadyevich laughed at this and liked it. In the same way, Levin in his heart despised the town mode of life of his friend and his official duties, which he laughed at and regarded as trifling. But the difference was that Oblonsky, since he was doing the same as everyone did, laughed assuredly and good-humoredly, while Levin laughed without assuredness and sometimes angrily. "We have long been expecting you," said Stepan Arkadyevich, going into his room and letting Levin's hand go as though to show that here all danger was over. "I am very, very glad to see you," he went on. "Well, what now? How are you? When did you come?" Levin was silent, looking at the unfamiliar faces of Oblonsky's two companions, and especially at the elegant Rinovich's hands, with such long white fingers, such long yellow nails curved at their end, and such huge shining studs on the shirt cuff, that apparently those hands absorbed all his attention and allowed him no freedom of thought. Oblonsky noticed this at once and smiled. "Oh, to be sure, let me introduce you," he said, "my colleagues. Philip Ivanich Nikitin, Mikhail Stanislavich Grinovich," and turning to Levin, "a Zemstvo member, a modern Zemstvo man, a gymnast who lifts 5 poods with one hand, a cattle breeder and sportsman, and my friend, Konstantin Dmitrievich Levin, the brother of Sergei Ivanovich Kuznetsov." "Delighted," said the veteran. "I have the honor of knowing your brother, Sergei Ivanovich," said Grinovich, holding out his slender hand with its long nails. Levin frowned, shook hands coldly, and at once turned to Oblonsky. Though he had a great respect for his half-brother, an author well known to all Russia, he could not endure it when people treated him not as Konstantin Levin, but as the brother of the celebrated Kuznetsov. "No, I am no longer a Zemstvo man. I have quarreled with them all and don't go to the sessions anymore," he said, turning to Oblonsky. "You've been quick about it," said Oblonsky with a smile. "But how? Why?" "It's a long story, I will tell you sometime," said Levin, but began telling him at once. Well, to put it shortly, I was convinced that nothing was really done by the Zemstvo Council, or could ever be, he began, as though someone had just insulted him. On one side, it's a plaything. They play at being a parliament, and I'm neither young enough nor old enough to find amusement in playthings. And on the other side, he stammered, it's a means for the coterie of the district to feather their nests. Formerly, they did this through wardships and courts of justice. Now they do it through the Zemstvo. Instead of taking the bribes, they take the unearned salary, he said, as hotly as though one of those present had opposed his opinion. Aha, you're in a new phase again. I see, a conservative, said Stepan Arkadyevich. However, we can go into that later. Yes, later, but I had to see you, said Levin, looking with hatred at Grinevich's hand. Stepan Arkadyevich gave a scarcely perceptible smile. But you used to say you'd never wear European dress again, he said, gazing on Levin's new suit, obviously cut by a French tailor. So, I see, a new phase. Levin suddenly blushed, not as grown men blush, slightly, without being themselves aware of it, but as boys blush, feeling that they are ridiculous through their shyness, and consequently ashamed of it, and blushing still more, almost to the point of tears. And it was so strange to see this sensible, manly face in such a childish plight that Oblonsky left off looking at him. Oh, where shall we meet? You know I want very much to talk to you, said Levin. Oblonsky seemed to ponder. I'll tell you what. Let's go to Gurin's to lunch, and there we can talk. I am free till 3. No, answered Levin after an instant's thought. I have another visit to make. All right, then. Let's dine together. Dine together? But I have nothing very particular, just a word or two, a question, then a little chatting. Well, let's have your word or two right now, and we'll talk it over in the course of the dinner. Well, it's this, said Levin. However, it's of no importance. His face suddenly assumed an expression of anger from the effort he was making to surmount his shyness. What are the Shcherbatskys doing? Everything as it used to be, he has said. Stepan Arkadyevich, who had long known that Levin was in love with his sister-in-law Kitty, gave a hardly perceptible smile, and his eyes sparkled merrily. You said your word or two, but I can't answer in a few words because... Excuse me for just a minute. The secretary came in with respectful familiarity and the modest consciousness, characteristic of every secretary, of superiority to his chief in the knowledge of affairs. He went up to Oblonsky with some papers and began, under pretense of asking a question, to explain some objection. Stepan Arkadyevich, without hearing him out, laid his hand genially on the secretary's sleeve. No, you do as I told you, he said, smoothing his remark with a smile, and with a brief explanation of his view of the matter, he moved away the papers and said, so do it that way, if you please, Zakhar Nikititch. The secretary retired in confusion. During the consultation with the secretary, Levin had completely recovered from his embarrassment. He was standing with elbows on the back of a chair, and on his face was a look of ironical attention. I don't understand it. I don't understand it, he said. What don't you understand, said Oblonsky, smiling just as cheerfully and picking up a cigarette. He expected some queer outburst from Levin. I don't understand what you are doing, said Levin, shrugging his shoulders. How can you be serious about it? Why not? Why, because there's nothing in it. You think so? Yet we're overwhelmed with work. On paper, but there, you've a gift for it, added Levin. That's to say, you think there's a lack of something in me? Perhaps so, said Levin, but all the same, I admire your grandeur, and am proud to have such a great person as a friend. You've not answered my question, though, he went on with a desperate effort, looking Oblonsky straight in the face. Oh, that's all very well. You wait a bit, and you'll come to this yourself. It's very nice for you to have 3,000 desiatinas in the Karazinsky district, and such muscles, and the freshness of a girl of 12. Still, you'll be one of us one day. Yes, as to your question, there is no change, but it's a pity you've been away so long. Oh, why so? Levin queried, frightened. Oh, nothing, responded Oblonsky. We'll talk it over. But what's brought you up to town? Oh, we'll talk about that, too, later on, said Levin, reddening again up to his ears. All right, I see, said Stepan Arkadyevitch. I should ask you to come to us, you know, but my wife's not quite well. But I'll tell you what, if you want to see them, they're sure now to be at the Zoological Gardens from 4 to 5. Kitty skates. You drive along there, and I'll come and fetch you, and we'll go and dine somewhere together. Capital. So goodbye to Lynn. Now mind, you'll forget. I know you, or rush off home to the country, Stepan Arkadyevitch called out laughing. No, truly. And Levin went out of the room, recalling only when he was in the doorway that he had forgotten to take leave of Oblonsky's colleagues. That gentleman must be a man of great energy, said Grinevich when Levin had gone away. Yes, my dear sir, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, nodding his head. He's a lucky fellow. 3,000 desiatinas in the Karazinsky district. Everything before him, and what youth and vigor. Not like some of us. But why are you complaining, Stepan Arkadyevitch? Why, it goes hard with me. Very bad, said Stepan Arkadyevitch with a heavy sigh. Chapter 6. When Oblonsky asked Levin what had brought him to town, Levin blushed and was furious with himself for blushing, because he could not answer. I have come to make your sister-in-law a proposal, though that was solely what he had come for. The families of the Levins and the Shcherbatskys were old, noble Moscow families, and had always been on intimate and friendly terms. This intimacy had grown still closer during Levin's student days. He had both prepared for the university with the young prince Shcherbatskys and the brother of Kitty and Dolly, and had entered at the same time with him. In those days, Levin was a frequent visitor at the house of the Shcherbatskys, and he was in love with the Shcherbatskys household. Strange as it may appear, it was with the household, the family, that Konstantin Levin was in love, especially with the feminine half of the household. Levin did not remember his own mother, and his only sister was older than he was, so that it was in the Shcherbatskys house that he saw for the first time that inner life of an old, noble, cultured, and honorable family, of which he had been deprived by the death of his father and mother. All the members of that family, especially the feminine half, were pictured by him, as it were, wrapped about with a mysterious poetical veil, and he not only perceived no defects whatever in them, but under the poetical veil that shrouded them, he assumed the existence of the loftiest sentiments and every possible perfection. Why, it was the three young ladies had one day to speak French and the next English. Why, it was that at certain hours they played by turns on the piano, the sounds of which were audible in their brother's room above, where the students used to work. Why, they were visited by those professors of French literature, of music, of drawing, of dancing. Why, at certain hours, all the three young ladies, with Mademoiselle Linen, drove in the coach to the Verskoy Boulevard, dressed in their satin cloaks, Dolly in a long one, Natalie in a half-long one, and Kitty in one so short that her shapely legs and tightly drawn red stockings were visible to all beholders. Why it was they had to walk about the Verskoy Boulevard, escorted by a footman with a gold cockade in his hat. All this and much more that was done in their mysterious world he did not understand, but he was sure that everything that was done there was very good, and he was in love precisely with the mystery of the proceedings. In his student days, he had all but been in love with the eldest, Dolly, but she was soon married to Oblonsky. Then he began being in love with the second. He felt, as it were, that he had to be in love with one of the sisters, only he could not quite make out which. But Natalie, too, had hardly made her appearance in the world when she married the diplomat, Lavar. Kitty was still a child when Levin left the university. Young Shcherbatsky went into the Navy, was drowned in the Baltic, and Levin's visits to the Shcherbatskys, despite his friendship with Oblonsky, became less frequent. But when early in the winter of this year Levin came to Moscow after a year in the country and saw the Shcherbatskys, he realized which of the three sisters he was indeed destined to love. One would have thought that nothing could be simpler than for him, a man of good family, rather rich than poor, and 32 years old, to make the young princess Shcherbatskaya an offer of marriage In all likelihood, he would at once have been looked upon as a good match. But Levin was in love, and so it seemed to him that Kitty was so perfect in every respect, a creature so far above everything earthly, while he was a creature so low and so earthly that it could not even be conceived that other people and she herself could regard him as worthy of her. After spending 2 months in Moscow in a state of befuddlement, seeing Kitty almost every day in society, into which he went so as to meet her, he abruptly decided that it could not be and went back to the country. Levin's conviction that it could not be was founded on the idea that in the eyes of her family, he was a disadvantageous and worthless match for the charming Kitty, and that Kitty herself could not love him. In her family's eyes, he had no ordinary, definite career and position in society, while his comrades by this time, when he was 32, were already one a colonel and another a professor, another director of a bank and railways or chairman of a board like Oblonsky. But he knew very well how he must appear to others, was a country gentleman, occupied in breeding cattle, shooting game, and building barns. In other words, a fellow of no ability, who had not turned out well, and who was doing just what, according to the ideas of the world, is done by people fit for nothing else. The mysterious, enchanting Kitty herself could not love such an ugly person as he conceived himself to be, and above all, such an ordinary, in no way striking person. Moreover, his attitude to Kitty in the past, the attitude of a grown-up person to a child, arising from his friendship with her brother, seemed to him yet another obstacle to love. An ugly, good-natured man, as he considered himself, might, he supposed, be liked as a friend. But to be loved with such a love as that with which he loved Kitty, one would need to be handsome and still more a distinguished man. He had heard that women often did care for ugly and ordinary men, but he did not believe it, for he judged by himself, and he could not himself have loved any but beautiful, mysterious, and exceptional women. But after spending 2 months alone in the country, he was convinced that this was not one of those passions of which he had had experience in his early youth, that this feeling gave him not an instant's rest, that he could not live without deciding the question as to whether she would or would not be his wife, that his despair had arisen only from his own imaginings, and that he had no sort of proof that he would be rejected. So he had now come to Moscow with a firm determination to make a proposal and get married if he were accepted, or he could not conceive what would become of him if he were rejected. Chapter 7. On arriving in Moscow by a morning train, Levin had put up at the house of his elder half-brother, Kosinchev. After changing his clothes, he went down to his brother's study, intending to talk to him at once about the object of his visit, and to ask his advice. But his brother was not alone. With him there was a well-known professor of philosophy, who had come from Charkov, expressly to clear up a difference that had arisen between them on a very important philosophical question. The professor was carrying on a hot crusade against materialists. Sergei Kosinchev had been following this crusade with interest, and after reading the professor's last article, had written him a letter stating his objections. He accused the professor of making too great concessions to the materialists, and the professor had promptly appeared to argue the matter out. The point in discussion was the question then in vogue: is there a line to be drawn between physical and physiological phenomena in man? And if so, where? Sergei Ivanovich met his brother with a smile of chilly friendliness he always had for everyone, and introducing him to the professor went on with the conversation. A little man in spectacles with a narrow forehead tore himself from the discussion for an instant to greet Levin, and then went on talking without paying any further attention to him. Levin sat down to wait till the professor should go, but he soon began to get interested in the subject under discussion. Levin had come across the magazine articles about which they were disputing and had read them, interested in them as a development of the first principles of science, familiar to him when a natural science student at the university. But he had never connected these scientific deductions as to the origin of man as an animal, as to reflex action, biology, and sociology, with those questions as to the meaning to himself of life and death, which had of late been more and more often in his mind. As he listened to his brother's argument with the professor, he noticed that they connected these scientific questions with those spiritual problems, that at times they almost touched on the latter. But every time they were close upon what seemed to him the chief point, they promptly beat a hasty retreat, and plunged again into a sea of subtle distinctions, reservations, quotations, allusions, and appeals to authority, and it was with difficulty that he understood what they were talking about. "I cannot admit it," said Sergei Ivanovich, with his habitual clearness and distinctness of expression and elegance of diction. "I cannot in any case agree with Keyes that my whole conception of the external world has been derived from impressions. The most fundamental idea, the idea of existence, has not been received by me through sensation. Indeed, there is no special sense organ for the transmission of such an idea." "Yes, but they, Wurst and Nost and Pripazov, would answer that your consciousness of existence is derived from the conjunction of all your sensations, that that consciousness of existence is the result of your sensations. Wurst, indeed, says plainly that, assuming there are no sensations, it follows that there is no idea of existence." "I maintain the contrary," began Sergei Ivanovich. But here it seemed again to Levin that, just as they were close upon the real point of the matter, they were again retreating, and he made up his mind to put a question to the professor. "According to that, if my senses are annihilated, if my body is dead, I can have no existence of any sort?" he queried. The professor, in annoyance and, as it were, mental suffering at the interruption, looked round at the strange inquirer more like a hauler of a barge than a philosopher, and turned his eyes upon him. Sergei Ivanovich, as though to ask, "What's one to say to him?" But Sergei Ivanovich, who had been talking with far less stress and one-sidedness than the professor, and who had sufficient breadth of mind to answer the professor, and at the same time to comprehend the simple and natural point of view from which the question was put, smiled and said, "That question we have no right to answer as yet." "We have not the requisite data," confirmed the professor, and he went back to his argument. "No," he said, "I would point out the fact that if, as Pripazov directly asserts, sensation is based on impression, then we are bound to distinguish sharply between these two conceptions." Levin listened no more and simply waited for the professor to go. Chapter 8. When the professor had gone, Sergei Ivanovich turned to his brother. "Delighted that you've come. For how long? How's your farming getting on?" Levin knew that his elder brother took little interest in farming and only put the question in deference to him, and therefore he told him only about the sale of his wheat and money matters. Levin had meant to tell his brother of his determination to get married and to ask his advice. He had indeed firmly resolved to do so. But after seeing his brother, listening to his conversation with the professor, hearing afterward the unconsciously patronizing tone in which his brother questioned him about agricultural matters — their mother's property had not been divided, and Levin took charge of both their shares — Levin felt that he could not for some reason broach to him his intention of marrying. He felt that his brother would not look on it as he would have wished him. "Well, how is your Zemstvo doing?" asked Sergei Ivanovich, who was greatly interested in Zemstvo's establishments and attached great importance to them. "I really don't know." "What? But surely you're a member of the board." "No, I'm not a member now. I've resigned," answered Levin, "and I no longer attend the sessions." "What a pity," commented Sergei Ivanovich, frowning. Levin, in self-defense, began to describe what took place at the sessions in his district. "That's how it always is," said Sergei Ivanovich, interrupted him. "We Russians are always like that. Perhaps it's our strong point, really, this faculty of seeing our own shortcomings. But we overdo it. We comfort ourselves with irony, which we always have on the tip of our tongues. All I say is, give such rights as our Zemstvo establishments to any other European people, and why, the Germans or the English would have worked their way to freedom with them, while we simply turn them into ridicule." "But how can it be helped?" said Levin penitently. "It was my last trial, and I did try with all my soul. I can't. I'm no good at it." It's not that you're no good at it, said Sergey Ivanovich. It is that you don't look at it as you should.
Perhaps not, Levin answered dejectedly.
Oh, do you know Brother Nikolai's turned up again?
This Brother Nikolai was the elder brother of Konstantin Levin, and half-brother of Sergey Ivanovich, a man who was done for, who had dissipated the greater part of his fortune, was living in the strangest and lowest company, and had quarreled with his brothers.
What did you say? Levin cried in horror. How do you know?
Prokofy saw him in the street.
Here in Moscow? Where is he?
Do you know? Levin got up from his chair as though on the point of starting off at once.
I'm sorry I told you, said Sergey Ivanovich, shaking his head at his younger brother's excitement.
I sent to find out where he is living and sent him his IOU to Trubin, which I paid. This is the answer he sent me.
And Sergey Ivanovich took a note from under a paperweight and handed it to his brother.
Levin read in the queer, familiar handwriting, I humbly beg you to leave me in peace. That's the only favor I ask of my gracious brothers. Nikolai Levin.
Levin read it and without raising his head stood with the note in his hand opposite Sergey Ivanovich. There was a struggle in his heart between the desire to forget his unhappy brother for the time and the consciousness that it would be base to do so.
He obviously wants to offend me, pursued Sergey Ivanovich, but he cannot offend me, and I should have wished with all my heart to assist him, but I know it's impossible to do that.
Yes, yes, repeated Levin, I understand and appreciate your attitude to him, but I shall go and see him.
If you want to, do, but I shouldn't advise it, said Sergey Ivanovich.
As regards myself, I have no fear of your doing so. He will not make you quarrel with me, but for your own sake, I should say you would do better not to go. You can't do him any good. Still, do as you please.
Very likely I can't do any good, but I feel, especially at such a moment, but that's another thing, I feel I could not be at peace.
Well, that's something I don't understand, said Sergey Ivanovich. One thing I do understand, he added, it's a lesson in humility. I have come to look very differently and more indulgently on what is called infamy since Brother Nikolai has become what he is. You know what he did?
Oh, it's awful, awful, repeated Levin.
After obtaining his brother's address from Sergey Ivanovich's footman, Levin was on the point of setting off at once to see him. But on second thought, he decided to put off his visit till the evening. The thing to do to set his heart at rest was to accomplish what he had come to Moscow for. From his brothers, Levin went to Oblonsky's office, and on getting news of the Shcherbatskys from him, he drove to the place where he had been told he might find Kitty. Chapter 9. At 4 o'clock, conscious of his throbbing heart, Levin stepped out of a hired sleigh at Zoological Gardens and turned along the path to the frozen mounds and the skating ground, knowing that he would certainly find her there, as he had seen the Shcherbatskys' carriage at the entrance. It was a bright, frosty day. Rows of carriages, sleighs, drivers, and gendarmes were standing in the approach. Crowds of well-dressed people with hats bright in the sun swarmed about the entrance and along the well-swept paths between the little houses adorned with carvings in the Russian style. The old, curly birches of the gardens, all their twigs laden with snow, looked as though freshly decked in sacred vestments. He walked along the path toward the skating ground and kept saying to himself, "You mustn't be excited. You must be calm. What's the matter with you? What do you want? Be still, foolish one," he conjured his heart. And the more he tried to compose himself, the more breathless he found himself. An acquaintance met him and called him by his name, but Levin did not even recognize him. He went toward the mounds, whence came the clank of the chains of sleighs as they slipped down or were dragged up, the rumble of the sliding sleighs and the sounds of merry voices. He walked on a few steps, and the skating ground lay open before him, and at once, amid all the skaters, he recognized her. He knew she was there by the rapture and the terror that seized his heart. She was standing talking to a lady at the opposite end of the ground. There was apparently nothing striking either in her dress or her attitude, but for Levin, she was as easy to find in that crowd as a rose among nettles. Everything was made bright by her. She was the smile that shed light on all around her. "Is it possible I can go over there on the ice approach her?" he thought. The place where she stood seemed to him a holy shrine, unapproachable, and there was one moment when he was almost retreating,
so overwhelmed was he with terror. He had to make an effort to master himself and to remind himself that people of all sorts were moving about her, and that he, too, might have come there to skate. He descended for a long while, avoiding looking at her as at the sun, yet seeing her as one does the sun without looking. On that day of the week and at that time of day, people of one set, all acquainted with one another, used to meet on the ice. There were skillful skaters there, showing off their skill, and beginners clinging to chairs with timid, awkward movements, and the boys and elderly people skating with hygienic motives. They seemed to Levin an elect band of blissful beings because they were here, near her. All the skaters, it seemed, with perfect self-possession, skated toward her, skated by her, even spoke to her, and were happy, quite apart from her, enjoying the capital ice and the fine weather. Nikolai Shcherbatsky, Kitty's cousin in a short jacket and tight trousers, was sitting on a bench with his skates on. Seeing Levin, he shouted to him, "Ah, the first skater in Russia. Been here long? First-rate ice. Do put your skates on." "I haven't got my skates," Levin answered, marveling at his boldness and ease in her presence, and not for one second losing sight of her, though he did not look at her. He felt as though the sun were coming near him. He was in a corner, and turning out her slender feet in their high boots, she, with obvious timidity, skated toward him. A boy in Russian dress, desperately waving his arms and bending down to the ground, overtook her. She skated a little uncertainly. Taking her hands out of the little muff that hung on a cord, she held them ready for emergency, and looking toward Levin, whom she had recognized, she smiled at him and at her own fears. When she had got round the turn, she got a start with one foot and skated right up to Shcherbatsky. Clutching at his arm, she nodded with a smile to Levin. She was more beautiful than he had imagined her. When he thought of her, he could call up a vivid picture of her to himself, especially the charm of that little fair head, so freely set on the shapely girlish shoulders, and so full of childish brightness and kindness. Her childish countenance, together with the delicate beauty of her figure, made up that special charm of hers, which he appreciated so well.